Welcome, very nice that you are all here tonight. I'd like just to introduce our panelists tonight, our discussion partners. I will start with Adania Schiebig. Adania Schiebig lives and works in Berlin and Palestine. She's a writer in residence at the Literaturhaus Zürich and PBG Foundation until the end of this year. She studied in Jerusalem and London and holds a PhD in Media and Cultural Studies from the University of East London. She has published 3 novels in Arabic, all of which have been translated into English, French, and Italian, and over 15 other languages. Minor Detail in German, Eine Nebensache, was published last year. A German translation, it's the first of her novels which is translated in German. It also made it straight onto the shortlist for the International Literature Prize on the House of World Cultures in Berlin and received the Literature Prize in June 2023. Schiebig's latest novel, Minor Detail, begins in the summer of 1949, 1 year after the Nakba. I hope the spelling is okay. This word is used in Arabic to describe the expulsion of more than 700 Palestinians from Palestine in the aftermath of the establishment of the State of Israel. Israeli soldiers capture a young Bedouin teenage girl, rape and kill her, and then bury her body in the sand. Many years later, in this minor detail that captivates a woman in Ramallah while stumbling across this story. Minor Detail is a reflection on language, war, violence, and the Palestinian experience of displacement and life under occupation. Then I would like to introduce Azina Gunal. It's very nice that you are here from Istanbul. Azina Gunal is the executive director of Anadolu Kültür, an organization on the intersection of art and civil society. The founder of Anadolu Kültür, Osman Kavala, was arrested and is in prison since October 2017, despite the European Court of Human Rights decision asking for the immediate release. Since then, Azina Gunal is the executive director of Anadolu Kültür. She worked as an editor at Iletişim Publishing House, where she was in charge of nonfiction books and the social science journal Toplum Revue. And from 2008 on, she was the program director of Depot, the arts and culture center of Anadolu Kültür in Istanbul. She obtained her BA in International Relations, MA in Sociology from MGU, and PhD from the Boğaziçi University at the Atatürk Institute. She was a fellow of the Alliance for Historical Dialogue and Accountability Program at the Columbia University in 2014, together with Murat Cevikanci, co-authored A City That Remembers, an alternative Istanbul guidebook that tells the stories of the social and cultural life of non-Muslims, of minorities, and human rights violations, as well as those of social movements for democracy and reconciliation. And on my right, Ilir Kazanay, welcome. Ilir Kazanay is a Swiss Kosovo film director. His parents came to Switzerland in the 1990s as political refugees. Ilir Kazanay grew up in Switzerland. Before graduating in film at the Zurich University of Arts, he worked several years as a computer scientist. His documentary film, Midash, had a successful run in international festivals between 2017 and 2020. including Toronto Hot Dogs Film Festival, Story Tour Film Festival, and Doku Fest, where it won the Audience Award. The latest film, as I was looking above, I could see myself underneath, unveils intimate stories of the LGBTQ persons from Kosovo, going through their unceasing search for a safe place that allows them to be. The film was screened at the festival Kino Kosova in Bern last week. Maybe you, somebody of you, I've saw it. He co-founded in 2018 the alternative cinema Kino Armata to offer free access to alternative culture in a multifunctional space in the center of Pristina. Furthermore, he leads the non-formal male school documentary school in Kosovo, which professionally guides new talents into the art of making their first short documentary. Yes, welcome everybody. What I'm wondering is, why do you think the Treaty of Lausanne is still relevant today, and what is the legacy of the Treaty of Lausanne? Maybe you can start us now.
Sure. Thanks. First, I would like to thank the organizers of this meeting. I was invited by both Politforum Bern and Istanbul Lausanne. So I would like to thank Kabi, Kob Kabi Pires and Stephanie for all their help. Lausanne is still relevant, and actually it's still discussed in the Turkish context, not in terms of minority rights, but more in terms of its secret articles. There is this conspiracy that in Lausanne there were some secret articles and they didn't let Turks to dig their own mines, and they were somehow exploiting Turkey through Lausanne, which is of course nonsense. But other than that, as we discussed before, it was not fully represented in the Turkish context this year. This year, actually, it's also the centenary of the foundation of the Turkish Republic. It was also not very much on the agenda. Of course, the earthquake affected all the public discourses and the discussions and the preparations for such things, but not the foundation of the Republic, neither the foundation of the Republic nor Lausanne have been very much on the agenda. But Lausanne has, in the Turkish context, has always been discussed through the rights of the minorities, because it is where the minorities are defined and their rights were defined. And it was basically the non-Muslims, Jews, Armenians, the Greeks, who were defined as minorities and who had the right to have their own schools and their communities and their representatives, but not the Kurds. And it is still relevant because, for example, last week I was in a meeting where a friend of mine was making a presentation about the recent migrant waves in Turkey. And at one point she said, now the Syrians are the biggest minority. And one person from the audience started shouting, "How can you say minority?" And she said, Kurds are the minority, then comes the Syrians. And he was like, "You're trying to divide the country. You cannot say minority to the Kurds, to the Syrians. They're not my." And the day after, he even sent a tweet tagging the Minister of Interior, accusing her for trying to divide the country. So it's still a very sensitive issue in Turkey, the rights of the minorities. Who is a minority? Who has the right to be a minority? And when you look at the context, Kurds do not have many of their rights. They don't have their separate schools, and they are not. There has been for years a war between the Kurdish guerrilla and the Turkish military, and now the peace process is left behind. Half of the Kurdish opposition is in prison. Plus, non-Muslims do not have their rights in full. As part of the accession to EU, there were some positive steps like giving back their properties because they confiscated the properties of the non-Muslims. In 2000, they gave back some of the properties, but still there are serious problems. For example, when it comes to electing their representatives, the state is interfering in those elections and not letting them to have, even when you look at the patriarchate, election of the patriarch of the Armenian community, state is still involved. So the state is trying to control the non-Muslim communities and not giving their rights in full. And many people do not have an idea about the existence of non-Muslims throughout the Turkish history and today. And many people do not know about the numbers there. For example, in the late Ottoman Empire, 20% of the population was non-Muslims. Now it's even less than 1%. In Turkey, in such a big populated country of 80 million, Greeks are 2,500, Jews are 15,000, and Armenians are 50,000, and they're located almost only in Istanbul because they didn't had the chance to live in other cities in Anatolia as they were seriously excluded and discriminated. So in such a context, as Anadolu Kültür, we are trying to bring, these issues on the agenda and bring different people together through culture and arts, as we find it still very relevant for a pluralistic and democratic society to evolve.
Thank you very much, Azina, for this outlining of these consequences of the Treaty of Lausanne in Turkey. This unification, this homogenization of the state, of the population. Yes, of the population. Adania, what is the legacy of Lausanne Treaty for Palestine, Israel? Because the peace conference in 1949 was also in Lausanne, and I read something about that. There were quotes of Kemalists as well. Yes, you have to divide. You have to divide these populations, and like before in Turkey, there were this Armenian and Greek, because after the Turkish-Greek war, the Greek were seen by the nationalists, Turkish nationalists, as inner enemies. They couldn't stay in the state again because they were enemies and threatened the state. And it was the same arguments also for dividing Palestine and Israel.
Yeah, it's when I was trying to go back and read more documents on the Lausanne Treaty, it offered to me actually more, not that only the legacy of Lausanne, but the prehistory of Lausanne, like this moment that we proceeded in history to Lausanne, and to understand the mindset of or the ideas that have been promoted to imagine how we can exist together as human beings. And it's all along division and homogeneous groups, which I think it is historically it's the early 20th century, proceeding later to a dark chapter in European history, which is actually being somehow imported as a governance structure to non-European countries. And you see it like perhaps I was looking at it, how with Greek nationalism and the demand for a homogeneous and controlled one group of society, and this idea moving throughout Europe and creating the nation state and the dangers of that. And we see like the persecution of Jewish Europeans. I see it as part of this almost legacy that was normalized elsewhere. We see here the crime of that. This is a crime, and that went extreme in terms of extermination. And whereas the application of this idea of one group, like eliminating any different groups within society in non-European contexts, like Turkey and demarcating Palestine and Lebanon and Syria with the aim of turning these countries into either Christian or Muslim. And within this process, also if you remember the Balfour Declaration that announced the creation of the state of a Jewish state in Palestine. What's interesting is the whole elimination of a way of living together that was existing, that perhaps with difficulties, but these difficulties did not reach a moment that required this exchange. And I'm thinking, when I was reading the documents, also how the Lausanne Treaty tried to introduce the nationality law, for instance, in Palestine, like to offer people the Palestinian nationality. And then the British interfered in that to suggest who can be a Palestinian who's not already preparing for the expulsion of Palestinians with the Balfour Declaration. And this case that the Treaty of Lausanne suggested everybody who was born there, who has roots there, can have a Palestinian nationality. And then the British changed that law and said, actually, Palestinians or non-Jewish Palestinians or non-Jews don't have the right for this nationality, even though they are born there, even if you went for a trip, suddenly if you did not apply for this nationality, you lost your Palestinian nationality, whereas Jewish Europeans were granted the Palestinian nationality. So you see the preparation already of what this, which I call ethnic cleansing, that will proceed until today. We see the political realities even in Iraq. Now we're moving, not even talking about Jews, Muslims, and Christians, we're talking about within the Muslims, the Shia and Sunni. So this extreme kind of lack of inability or imagining how we can exist together and be feeling the richness of these differences completely departed the political imagination and was entrenched in a kind of peace treaty, which I think it's very ironic, the name. It's since this peace treaty, we only have seen wars in these regions and that they continue.
Yes. It's this kind of, thank you very much for giving these explanations. It was seen as a model for peacemaking. No, it was really in Lausanne, the convention between Greece and Turkey about the so-called population exchange was for peace, because they can't live together. We have to separate them, and it's that the only possibility to have peace in this region. And this is like a model that was until now. I think that if you come to you earlier, maybe you can explain a little bit in the Balkan or in Kosovo, what does it mean, this legacy of taking this as a model, this unmixing people as a model for peacemaking, if there are conflicts, because conflicts can take the roots of conflicts or elsewhere maybe. Not, and is this a model? How was it in Kosovo?
Thanks. Thanks for inviting me. I'm very happy to be here. Maybe just to have a bit of an understanding, Kosovo, I was born in 86, and already there the whole country, if we call it the country of Yugoslavia, was already shifting. They said that Tito, who led Yugoslavia from after the Second World War, that the idea was to destroy nationalism, to like make it as something which you don't look what nationality you're all from, but this theoretic idea of equalness and also the idea of the socialistic country of Yugoslavia was to mix the people so that nationalism, or how they also like to call it maybe in the newer days, this ghettoism, that it's not created sort of to like make it dead before it sprouts. And but this, of course, it's very dangerous, because always in theory most of the things sound very, very nice and tangible, but then when you really come to the practice, it means, what does it mean, and what does how much you oppress than the people. And Kosovo, which it was very high majority, as it is also now, is Albanians. And through history, because of the Ottoman Empire and over, because, you know, like nationalities came later, and how we understand borders and the identity of nationality, it sort of was created maybe also through France and revolutions. But this was really like, you know, sort of groups of people living together and getting along. And so when the Ottoman Empire came, the Albanians, especially in Kosovo, were always had somebody who sort of oppressed them or made them either convert to the Islam. And then after the fall of the Ottoman Empire, and then Serbia took it as a part of its kingdom. Like, and so it's I think for to come back, when I was born, Albanians in Kosovo were always, you know, the little ones, the minority in a bigger, due to the language, like other parts of Yugoslavia, like Croatia, Bosnia, Serbia, Slovenia, and Macedonia. It's sort of the same language. You understand each other, maybe differences, little differences. But so Albanians were always the minority in that region, and also had it really hard to exist and to be there. And throughout the time, there was this there was this stereotype created of the Albanians who are a lower, people, who are like, they made things up that Albanians come from the woods, meaning like less intelligent or stupid, all these. And so it was really like infused. And I still know that, I know that Albanians have it towards maybe Serbs, that you have this maybe complexity, inferior, you feel inferior, you feel like lower. And it's very interesting that I now can see both sides, you know, like we were very long on the side of minority, and now since after the war, of course Balkans wars, but then also the Kosovo war, now are the Albanians the majority. And this brings, of course, completely different responsibilities, because as a majority, you always have more responsibilities, especially towards the minorities. But this also means that you are in power, or you have more power. And I think we can maybe later go more in detail. But what I just want to mention is that Kosovo is really in a difficult position, because just its existence is always questioned. It's 2023, and if Kosovo should exist or if it should be a state is still a question. It's still, you know, like not something like, okay, we have Switzerland, we have Greece, or we have Turkey, and we all agree of its existence. I guess with Palestine, I wouldn't say the same, but it goes in that direction. This makes even this creation of identity and looking for all the laws connecting identity of a state and understanding it makes it much harder. And especially also just last weekend, there was a terrorist attack in the northern border of Kosovo, which there were Serbian militia or trained forces with a lot of very, very, very heavily armed. And this makes it, you know, like a really dangerous ground, because Kosovo has a very destructive neighbor, Serbia. And this is especially, you know, hard for the majority, for the Albanians, because it needs to be, we have to be very careful, because then this can be used to say, look what the Albanians are doing, what the minorities. And so I think also this is very actual. I don't know if I...
No, it's okay. It's really, it's the impact also of this, told it before, the diversity in the empires also. We lived in this region, even if it was complicated and it was not on an equal base or so, but people lived together, and now it's really the loss of this, and the continuity of the loss of this diversity. And what I'm wondering now, what is this doing to the society even in regions like Kosovo or Palestine as well, where the state is not acknowledged by the whole international community, but not by all the people, all the nations and so on. What does this mean to society? What does it mean? It's a loss in Turkey as well. It's a loss, this for living together. Maybe we could develop these ideas.
I really listened to the word of responsibility when you brought it, because it's rarely that this word comes in terms of relations of majorities and minorities. And for me, actually, it's very funny, because you mentioned the example of this person who's objecting for the term minority from this, like, no, we are one. On the other hand, I came from a different kind of experience where minority are used to strip you of your sense of equality. And there's never a sense of responsibility in terms of these relations. Actually, it's a nice word to bring into thinking together, like the responsibility of those who have, or those who enjoy a position of power, of not needing to worry about their language or their being or ways of life, and how they can feel responsible to minorities. And it's rarely so. The minorities are often ending up feeling inferior, because inferiority is somehow what activates these power relations between a majority and a minority, where you think, I have the right to exist as I wish to, or no, I should be grateful for the little that I have compared to the majority. And I know this complex quiet when in the context of Palestine, Israel, because, you know, this is a whole shift of relations that you encounter every day, that it reaches also your sense of self, or even to language, to your who you are, what kind of relations you can create with others. If you're constantly haunted by you are a lesser human being, you are lesser, you are part on the side, on the margins, and therefore you feel this is poisoning your relationship to the others. And sometimes I think, okay, I think the nation state created a lot of destruction. I didn't witness so far the amazing size of nation states. And then I'm thinking, okay, and especially in the context of Palestine, I mean, you know, there is the creation of the state of Israel. This is a nation state. It proposes a certain structure, who deserves to come in, who is allowed to move, who is allowed not to move. And you have a very designed, I mean, the whole state is putting its energy in differentiating, in designing your movement, even in designing how you relate, how you love, how you're unable to love, because you don't trust those around you. And when you think, do we want to reproduce this structure or this idea of being together, are we going to repeat what the Israelis are doing or any other nation state? Or is it a chance, as you mentioned, of perhaps we can, because we are not still this nation state, because we don't have the structure, to use these experiences and different ways of seeing and witnessing to think of a different form of being together. And I think this is the only way that can liberate you from the inferiority complex you're constantly being pushed. Because this inferiority complex can't, you constantly want to copy the powerful. But the minute that you say, I don't want to copy the powerful, I don't want to copy the structure of a nation state, you are free. You don't have to copy it. You are not a lesser human being because you don't have it. So it can be, though it's a very difficult situation, it can be a moment, an inspiring moment of investigation, how we can be together, how we can create relations as human beings with each other, where difference is not a question that we are taking it or not taking it, but it is the necessary way of living. You have to have it. It's not that you are generous to accept difference. And this difference could be on language, on behaviors, on any way of living.
Yes, thank you very much for this idea of should it be really a nation state that we have? It's a question for in future. So is this really, yes, worse to copy it for so-called minorities? It's also a question for the Kurds. You see there, they try to organize in another way. For example, Rojava is just another form of organizing themselves, being together, of togetherness. And maybe in Kosovo, there are also this kind of trying to organize, not in the like any other nation state, that maybe it will be a way out of the trap also of this of nation state. But let me come to another question. In this development of maybe new narratives of a state or of being together or living together, the role of culture, of the arts, how do you see this? Is there, what kind of role arts and
culture has? The most important role.
The most important role, yes.
Most important role.
India. Most important role.
Yeah, I mean, of course, it's art should always be the critical view or, you know, or artists in that regard. I think maybe when we look at the role of religion, what importance it had, I think that now this importance of religion, it shifted to culture and arts, because I think it's a place where you see different views, and it should be a place or a feeling which should take its time to be critical about things that happen around us or emphasize. And this is so, you know, you can see if art would be gone, this democracy or unfree democracy or fake democracy, I don't know how you want to call it, they would be very, very quickly, they would become these hateful organisms, I feel like, because because you there needs to be this entire power which is outside of the role of the state, which has its space to work outside of the system in a way. I mean, of course, it sounds weird because we're in the capital, capitalistic state and all this. I know sometimes it can be hard, but I think this is really these are the questions, because everything is corruptible, even democracy sometimes. I also ask myself, in Switzerland, is it really a pure democracy if we allow to have all these advertisements? And of course, the bigger parties, they will have more people who see it. And so,
because of the elections now, yeah.
I mean, this is just one side, but it's, I think, this is the one side, and the other is culture has its power, because we it is sort of that line, and I can compare it again to Switzerland and in Kosovo. I can really see that it's not there. For example, when I went to Kosovo in 2015. There was only one cinema in the capital, and it was like this Hollywood cinema which played all the blockbusters. And Pristina city has around 400,000 citizens, with the neighboring villages. And Zurich, because I lived in Zurich, has 400,000 only in the city, but it has over 33 alternative cinemas. Not the blockbusters included. And so you can really see that it's so important that people can come together and that they get exposed to all these questions that comes from culture and from getting together and experiencing art, or just to see a picture, or this observation. I don't know if I'm making too broad, but it's really these spaces are so important. I guess it's like a relationship. You maybe know it too late when you don't have it.
Asina, would you share your thoughts? Because for 21 years you were with Anadolu Kültür, opening up spaces, making programs. I think it's also what you believe in, that
from the beginning on, actually, it was based on the belief that through culture and arts, we can bring people together from different ethnicities, religions, or languages. And I remember when Osman Kavala was awarded Hrant Dink Award. There is this award in the name of the assassinated Armenian journalist. He in his speech, he was saying that for dialogue and for mutual understanding, for reasoning, to develop our capacities in terms of coming together with other people, talking to other people, understanding other people, and to have a reasoning, we need actually literature, culture, and arts. These are the things that develop our capacities in terms of getting to know and listen others. And it, because it keeps your imagination and hope alive, and it doesn't need translation, it doesn't need mediation. So throughout all these years, Anadolu Kültür has used culture and arts to bring, for example, repressed histories into public memory. We have done a lot on the past human rights violations in Turkey, about the Armenian genocide, about what happened to the Kurdish people or Alevi populations or women or LGBT. So to bring these into public memory, we wanted people to learn about these and to discuss these. For example, you mentioned, I mean, population exchange with Lausanne. There was another, I mean, forced migration in 1964 due to the Cyprus crisis. At one night, Turkey decided to send the Greeks in Istanbul, who has double passports, and 12,000 Greeks had to leave their homes, just taking with them a certain amount of money, which is like $20, and 20 kilos of, I mean, what they have. So we organized an exhibition called $20, 20 kilos, telling the stories of those people who had to leave Istanbul in 1964 during the 50th anniversary of it. Many people are not aware of these stories. So through culture and arts, through these exhibitions, we make, also we want to make people learn about these, discuss these, not to repeat those, I mean, atrocities again, to learn from the past at the same time. Or in other projects, we are bringing young people from eastern cities together with those from western cities so that they listen to each other's stories. I mean, for example, there is this film in the Lausanne exhibition on the about the people living in Imroz Island, the Greeks living in Imroz Island. It was done as part of this project called Bach, Revealing the City Through Memory, where we bring young people from other parts of Turkey to develop a photography or video project together. And they are digging into the stories from the old days, but they're also listening to each other's stories through both, I mean, projects. Those from the West are learning the, I mean, the atrocities still going on in the eastern part of Turkey. So art and culture is helping us, I mean, to, I mean, both in terms of developing our human capacities, capabilities, but also in terms of listening to, I mean, knowing others' stories.
Yes, thank you. You said power. Yes, it's the power. We need arts and culture. It's the most important now for example, to imagine another way to live together or to manage crises we have nowadays.
Yes, yeah, certainly. I mean, in context, I would speak about Palestine, Israel. I think culture and art there are the necessary condition for you to continue. It's not a bourgeois practice that you go and you enjoy in your leisure time. It's what allows you to regain your humanity that is constantly being attacked and destroyed. And I think it's I often experience it as the moment where you perhaps leave reality. And unknowingly, you leave reality for a minute to regain any sense of yourself through art, through working in art, through relating to the world through art. And I see it a lot, for instance, with artists in Gaza, because Gaza is a very active, it has a very active, very energetic, artistic scene. I was in few committees, like most of the for literature, and most of the applications they come from Gaza. Most of the visual arts are happening in Gaza and films. And then you understand that art and culture, they are really the only way you can grab hold yourself and manage to not to accept reality, but to know that this reality is not where you would like to belong, but somewhere else. So imagination becomes really the line of life for you. It's where you rethink and think and open up the new possibilities. And sometimes I think also about language, because we go back to what language, what kind of terms are available for us to work with imagining being together, how we imagine to be together. And in the context of Palestine, of course, we don't have state institutions to work with. The state is an oppressive apparatus, whether it's the Israeli government offices or the Palestinian Authority, which is being supported by the Israelis. There are very oppressive structures that you cannot work with. So you always exist outside them, and you need to navigate life outside them and to find methods of support outside there. And so you have a lot of activities and cultural activities that they are taking place outside state institutions. You don't have that. And therefore, I think perhaps we can imagine a place where you can exist and you can think of ways to do together, to live together, that they are not only governed by structures of state. Last time, a year and a half ago, when I was in Palestine, I always tried to visit different cities, also because to be against this limitation imagination of you cannot travel to other cities. For instance, if you go to Hebron now from Ramallah, it used to take in the past 40 minutes. Now it takes you 3 hours. So this obstacle, it does not, of time, you know, if you go there, the way is very hard, there are several checkpoints. You cannot even imagine that you create a relationship with somebody. But they try to work with this kind of limitations with others. How, with whom are we? So if you go to Ramallah, you're imprisoned in Ramallah, but I make the point also to travel with my son. We go everywhere. We go this long trip. It's really tiring. You need to sleep 3 days after such a trip. But in these trips, you meet people who are working in these cities and how much they are happy to receive you because you are breaking these limitations and even imagining to go to that city. Let's not even imagine being living together, but imagine moving. And I am lucky to be able to move because I have the right papers. Others don't, and many people don't. Anyway, when I arrive there, I meet with a group of artists who try to mix methods of artistic methods with scientific methods and how to relate to history through imagination. So they try to look at the city and move in the city not from this scientific knowledge or position, but from a position of let's incorporate also the imaginative to relate to the city differently. And one beautiful word that came across is neighboring. Because they told me when we were going to the city is now controlled by 500 settlers, the old town, and we needed to walk in the old town. It's very dangerous to walk there, but we decided to walk. And they tried to bring a different imagination of these relations of the Jewish inhabitants of the city and the Muslim inhabitants of the city. So you see reality. You see Jewish settlers with machine guns. They are very threatening, and you see the city is deserted. But for them, they walk in the city, and they recall a different moment in time where there was a different relation between the Jewish and the Muslim community. And they talk about the fall of Andalusia in the 15th century, and how people, Jews and Muslims, came from Andalusia to the city to neighbor the shrine, the religious space of Abraham. This place is full of all this religious stuff. Anyway, so they go to neighbor, and they talk about neighboring as an important relation. And when I think about neighboring, it completely leaves you away from the idea of a refugee, because now how we relate to people coming to our vicinity, we relate to them as refugees, as we need to welcome them or not welcome them. But I think thinking about it, how these young artists were talking about the term neighboring, basically you become immediately equal. You are not a refugee or a previous resident. You are here, and we are as neighbors supporting each other. And I was thinking about this term. So it's one term that we can also shift this a state, a nation state, and who is a citizen and who is not a citizen, and who's allowed to have these rights and who is not. And this word neighboring suddenly completely collapses, and no, you're just a neighbor, and we are equal in our relation to the city and to each other. So I'm mentioning that because I'm trying to think sometimes which terms we can dig in our daily life and can help us come up with different political imagination.
It's an interesting term, neighborhood. You heard it?
Oh, neighboring. The act of neighboring.
Yes.
Yes.
You making neighbors.
Yeah.
Making neighbors. Making neighbors.
Yes.
Did you hear about this?
Not
this term is interesting.
I guess what I can say is also through people who will talk more about their neighbors, because it was more mixed. Now it's when after the war, it's not really that kind of, you know, you had Albanians, you had Serbs, and they would live together. You had also other non-minorities, and it wasn't that of a big deal in that terms, because it was just normal. I mean, this experience that it becomes sort of a habitat, it becomes normal. This is very, very important, but this has, I guess this is more possible if all the parties in there come to a more or less same conclusion, where you agree that you want to live together and that you respect one another apart from what your nationality is or your race in that sense. And of course I hear a lot of people, especially maybe more in the bigger cities in Kosovo, that miss that kind of livelihood where you would just live together and not all the time had this, where the first idea of you is what are our differences, but we need to clean the park, or we need to, you know, like, when it's very loud, we need to do something against it, or in that sense, I think this is really good. And I also, I can maybe also talk about it in Switzerland. I think it's really good when there is a very healthy mix of people, because then of course you create this division, and then it's us against them, and then it's they are doing this. But I don't want to hint like it's in our head. It really exists if you have a certain power structure which really works in that kind of way, where you are oppressed, you don't get the same possibilities as the others do. And I think this is really something that we need to fight in. I can say I experienced racism in Switzerland, but I never experienced racism in Switzerland like somebody who is, you know, a person of color, or who is a woman, or who is queer, because these are all steps that just come together, and it's more important. Connected to Kosovo is we have minorities which the Albanian, the majority, needs to take care that these people have the same possibilities. For example, the Roma are maybe also historically or in a very, very heavy surroundings, because they are historically poor from history onwards. And so in Kosovo, it's sort of the same, that they need to fight for survival, for a living. And compared to that, I very often hear people who say, oh, they just have to want it. They just need to want to make something, they can be successful. And this is very ignorant, because these people who say these kinds of things are just ignoring the fact that we are not starting at the same starting point.
Yes.
And for example, like, how can you ask from somebody to be able to even have a company or to be financially safe if they have to live day by day? And so I think these terms, these privileges, I think they are very much connected in, you know, either can be nationality, it can be faith, religion, it can be identity, sexuality, all these things. These come together with privileges, and then the ones who are privileged, they don't want to give away these privileges.
Actually, what I was thinking is very much related to what you both said. In Turkey, every year there is this poll, and they're asking people with whom you do not want to be neighbors with. And it's usually the non-Muslims, Kurds, and LGBT people, and these are really high percentages. I mean, people do not want to be neighbors with them, and this shows they don't want to be equal with them. They don't want to have the same, I mean, life with them. They don't want to be defined on equal terms with them. It's very, I mean, whenever I read it, I feel depressed about society. But this is, and because neighboring means, as you said, being equal at the same time, and they don't want to be equal.
But it's very interesting that such poems are being proposed. So you always have to think, with whom I don't want to be a neighbor. You should have also a poem say, with whom I would like to be a neighbor. You know? So I think this is also the constant negativity brought in the term and the sharing. And I think also stays with the issue of people seeking asylum. I mean, they are being isolated. They are not, maybe we're not being at the moment allowed to ask whom our neighbor is or whom we would like, but it is according to the law you cannot. And it's very interesting because decades ago, or it was not, I recall there's the Gershom Luca, who is a Jewish Romanian poet and surrealist, and he moved in the 50s to France without any papers, and he was renting flats without a problem until Sarkozy came to government in the 90s, and he was the Minister of Interior. And then it was introduced that if you're a refugee, you cannot rent, which is now, it's for us, the norm. A refugee cannot come and rent. They have to have the papers. But so it is like we are moving towards who's living in this building. It's all people who are legally cannot rent the flat if you're not. Whereas until the 90s, it was possible. And in fact, he was evicted, and he survived the Nazis. He survived so many things, but he couldn't survive this law. And he committed suicide when he was 90. He was evicted from his flat at the age of 80 in the 90s. And you see how society also loses, how it loses an important part of itself.
Yeah, what is a society? I mean, a society is different people living together, so we are losing that quality, not only in terms of these ethnic, I mean, or religious or language-based divisions, but also in terms of political divisions. I mean, yeah, if you ask me how would you define Turkey at the moment, I would say highly polarized, highly differentiated on a political basis. And I feel like it lost this characteristic of being a society, because we are not having our joy together, happiness together, or even the sorrow together. Even after the earthquake, there was a polarization. I mean, we didn't feel united to, fight with that, what happened afterwards. Let's go together and try to wake those cities back up together. It wasn't the case. People were blaming each other. And, I mean, it's in that sense getting really worse. And I don't know what will be the role of culture and arts dealing with a polarized society in the age of post-truth. It's a big question for me.
It's definitely a big, big challenge, because what you said before, that you can't imagine society without culture, it became hate or income and so on. It's really, cruel things. But I have to stop here for something. I have a last question after the opening to the public. Maybe you...
Yeah, because otherwise we could continue on.
Could it not be said that culture artists create a minority of their own? This is a devil's advocate question. To what extent is culture or the arts available to all?
Yeah, it is a question. It is also a question I think we're asking ourselves. What is our role within what's happening? And it's a question, it is a dilemma constantly. It's a question also about sensibility and how you deal with this relation, especially in times of crisis. But I think it is a question of privilege and impossibility, and there's an attack on it. It's not like because artists, they would like to be isolated in a minority, they end up like that. And on one side, you have the market, the global art market, and making elites of certain artists and access to art. But there are other situations where culture is being attacked and limited, not because it's a matter of a choice. I mean, think in Palestine, books are banned since 20 years. So it's not that I can claim, okay, I write books, but people cannot read them, not because I'm a minority and I'm an elitist, not because there is a whole government and border structure that does not allow books. So it's not a matter of choice. And even if it's a choice, it's a... I think it's not directed so much as a feeling or wishing for a separation as much as trying to listen to be sincere with what you're doing. I know I cannot do with my literature to do big claims, and I'm not going to use literature because I don't want to have this relationship to it. But perhaps we can do something else that come, you know, reading a book, writing a book, and reading a book, it is meeting in a different way. So it's also, I know if I write a book, it's no longer mine. I just wrote it, but it has its own life with every reader. And therefore, it's a different relation. It's not like we're all, actually all writers hate each other, they say. So we're not even a community or a minority.
And the filmmakers.
directors. I mean, I guess it's you know, I think I like the question because it makes you think what is actually your purpose, and it's especially maybe in art, it's so hard to, it's not like a mathematical formula. It's like 400 people saw it, now 30 of them think how different, and maybe two of them have an awe effect, and I'm a hero or something. It's not, it's very hard to measure something, and I think when you start to measure, then I guess also your arts will become corrupted, because then the idea why you started to write that story or to make this film was to get a certain reaction from your audience, and not to really say something that you personally want to say, but which is important. And I think maybe nowadays we produce a lot of content, so I guess it makes it harder to have this effect that classical films sometimes had, where you knew that this film has a really strong impact, and this is also why it's a classic, and it, you know, like made something with people. And what is very dangerous is that you can do this for good things, but you can do it also for bad things. And one prime example is Birth of a Nation in 1915. This film was made by the David W. Griffith, so very racist American director who like took white actors and painted them in black to play black people, and he put them in the film as horrible people.
As rapists.
Yeah, as rapists, very quickly. And this had a lot to do with the KKK, right? The Ku Klux Klan was just going down. People weren't really identifying with them. But then this film came out where the KKK is very, you know, like heroic. They look for safety and they're the good guys. And it changed the history. Like it really, KKK became a huge client. It spread around America, and this is only one story. And they made it very simple, you know, these are the good guys, these are the bad guys. And I guess also in the Second World War, the Nazis used this kind of propaganda film, and we can really see that it's very easy to make these stories that, you know, get to the people and can make this place a really horrible place. I just think it's we have to see that we give these stories, we're more careful, and this means that the people who are in power to be able to make these stories, that they are diverse, that we have stories from women, we have people of color, we have queer people, so we get the diversity. And it's because, I mean, if we think, why are we now in the position that we are all the influences of the things that we saw, which arts is too. We are the influences from the Hollywood films or the classics, who where women roles were always very small. They would never take decisions. They would always go to the man to ask for advice and help. And so, I mean, this is very, it goes very down. So I think it's very important that the artist and the community knows this. And I would like to maybe add my part just to answer this question. I'm a very big fan of James Baldwin. And he said what it meant to him and his identity as a black person. He said that he always loved the John Wayne movies, where the cowboys would always kill the Indians, and he would always identify with John Wayne, with the cowboys. They are the good guys. Until maybe he reached the age of six, and for the first time he looked in the mirror, he saw himself in the mirror, and he realized that he's black. And so his whole world shifted, because he understood in that moment, I'm not the cowboys, I'm the Indians. And this is my interpretation, that I think it also is very important how we tell the stories and what the message is.
That's a very nice short film about his Istanbul days. Mm-hmm. You know, he found refuge in Istanbul and he lived there.
Yeah. I was even in the museum to saw the picture.
Other questions?
I was thinking about how to bring together the stories. I think you were talking about stories. I like it very much. And you were talking about neighboring. And I'm just trying to knit it together somehow, because I'm involved quite much involved in Ukraine. There are now new separations between IDPs and local people and so on, and refugees and exiles and immigrants from before. So they're trying to find a new identity, common identity, without falling into the nationality trap. And this is really very difficult and very risky. And so what we do is really working with stories. And I think neighboring comes in here. It's not the local, necessarily a local neighboring. It can also be a daily experience-based neighboring. It's not geographically speaking, but emotionally. And is it, I wonder, especially for Turkey, because in Ukraine, you see that women are much more likely to find commonalities because they share their daily tasks, their care work, and they find, wherever they come from, but they find all of a sudden, yes, I did it. And we did some Etzel Cafe. It's a storytelling cafe. Starting with a table. The table, and they started to tell stories. And all of the participating women, wherever they came from, they could participate. So they created kind of a new community, and I think this storytelling, it's not art, but it's a cultural instrument, which is, I don't know if you have the same experience, really a big impact on the self-confidence also of the participants, of the women.
Yeah, sure. I mean, I totally agree. And usually we work with young people when it comes to storytelling. For example, we brought Turkish and Armenian young people together, and it was called Speaking to One Another, and they had trainings on oral history and then went to the villages in Turkey and in Armenia and talked to the older generation people and collected their stories so that they get familiar with what happened. Because when you talk about, for example, 1915 Armenian genocide, I mean, these thousands, millions of people died, and it was, I mean, this did that. With the historical facts, of course we should be talking about the historical facts. But when you talk about the stories of the people, when you tell those stories, it's much easier to communicate. For example, at DEPO, our art center, we have been realizing projects with Armenians from diaspora, from Armenia and Turkey. And usually it is the stories of the people, mostly the women actually, to tell through arts and like videos and photography. I remember this video shot by a friend of mine telling the story of a 104-year-old Armenian lady who, during the genocide, escaped to Armenia and who was living there, and she was still remembering those days. And she was talking about, I mean, not only killings, but also rape and other atrocities. Still, at one point, she was saying, "Oh, you're from Turkey. Say hi to those living in Turkey." And it's such a touching movie. I mean, when I explain it, it's not the same effect, I know. But whenever I watch it, I was crying. And I was, I mean, watching it with several people. And you cannot catch this with, like, putting the numbers and, I mean, historical facts and documentation. This is the power of stories, I mean, personal stories. Then people start to ask questions and listen to other stories and get to know more about what happened.
Is this film available?
Yes, it's actually on Vimeo. I can give you the link and you can have a look at it. Yes, it's with subtitles. It's a very short film, but very powerful.
Listening to you, I remember, like, in Arabic, the word for literature and ethics is the same. So, adab, which is basically, you can understand from that literature can provide you a ground, even if it's related to imagination, a ground for acting and interacting with or relating to others, which I find actually work more, perhaps for me, more than passing a message, but a form of relation. It is a relation that we come to it from different positions, which includes storytelling. And the fascinating thing about storytelling that it's not about telling something, but it is a certain way of telling, which includes not telling, because I don't think people who experience pain certainly want to speak about that, but they relate to it differently, and perhaps this is where ethics come in. The ethics of what you experience, how you can create compassion, and with the fact that it's constantly changing, it's not fixed, and creating a sense of the self with speaking to another, telling a story to another, it also perhaps tells us that the sense of the self or the identity doesn't need to be fixed. It is in the making, in the making with others. And this is very important to remember. We're not like this. This is our identity. It's a terrible, I think, term. But yeah.
What is it? Edebiyat in Arabic?
Adab.
Adab is also adab.
Yes, thank you all so much. It's really, really interesting and important. I was thinking about the context of Turkey and the important work that you all do there, and thinking about outreach and the given the fact that conditions are so polarized. I wonder if you, or could you maybe tell us more about your experiences in trying to reach those that don't want to be neighbors, that don't want to know? Do you have strategies to reach our, just your experiences with this problem?
Yeah, actually, it's a big question for me, whether we're reaching those who do not want to be neighbors. But I have seen moments that people, for example, coming to an exhibition and changing their ideas about what happened. In one of the panels on the Armenian genocide, it was a side event of an exhibition. There was a discussion between the one person from the audience and the panelists, and I realized that person changed his mind there in that moment. So these things are happening, and I mean, of course, people are saying to each other, and they're coming, but it's not like the thousands in Turkey. We cannot reach them, and I mean, I wish we can, but we are on the agenda more with, unfortunately, the imprisonment of Osman Kavala. And he was also accused of, for example, I mentioned that in the second indictment about him, he was accused of trying to divide the country by providing a space for non-Muslims and Kurds through culture and arts. So these can be used against you, but still we insist on what we do, because we know that these things are changing the lives of people. I mean, either as an audience member, but also as a participant. I mean, especially, as I mentioned, for those young people who participated in our project, many of them became like film directors or photographers, and we are providing them a platform to have their careers, which is very important. I mean, their minds are changing, but also they are having capacity, network, all those, which is very important. And what last year was our 20th anniversary, and we decided to have an activity report and prepared some infographics. And when we counted the number of exhibitions, concerts, and the projects we did, and the number of people that we somehow touched, it was something, it was really quite many. And we felt good about it. But of course, our impact is not the same with the impact of a popular TV series. For example, in Netflix, there was this popular TV series called Club. And all of a sudden, everyone realized, oh, there were Jews in Turkey. They were speaking another language called Ladino. So this, of course, you cannot compete with a Netflix series, but still we are doing our best to reach as many as possible.
Last question, maybe?
Yes, if there is.
Yes?
There is still time. I mean, I found it very interesting to observe how actually the Lausanne Treaty kept the podium, the panel, also discussing in a very national frame, actually. So nationalist perspective forces you to think in this frame. And I thought it was really kind of a relief when you left this very narrow perspective. So I think that's a problem of the point of departure maybe here. But what I think this peacemaking through Lausanne that was actually causing a lot of displacement simultaneously created all these diasporas that are going on. And I think back in the 1990s, we were much more optimistic about transnational relations and connectedness, what could be something like distant neighborhood. And somehow I feel with this increase of nationalist, populist, right-wing, conservatism, we are also losing this strength of transnational connectedness. And art is per se transnational and has a global impact. And I think this, I would kind of like to hear a little bit of perspectives, particularly from organizations that have to work so much on the national ground, like Anadolu Kultur. I mean, and simultaneously have an impact that goes way beyond. And
yeah.
It's not a clear question. It's more like thoughts.
Yeah, thank you. I mean, you're right. I mean, we are still, I mean, I'm still talking from where I live and always referring to the Turkish context. But at the same time, we are connected with artists and curators and cultural managers and social scientists from around the world, actually. And what, for example, at DEPO, we have been hosting projects from abroad a lot. We have an online journal titled Red Thread, where we bring artists, curators from the neighboring countries of Turkey. We just released our 6th issue. It's an online journal with a board from Serbia, Austria, Turkey, Egypt, and Armenia. So we have those transnational connections, and we are trying to bring their works to Turkey and bring the works in Turkey to abroad. But yes, I mean, when you look at the intellectual discussions in Turkey, I can say it's still very local. Even the leftist intellectuals are kind of very local, not referring to what's going on outside. Comparing art with other disciplines, it's actually the most transnational one in Turkey. And the artists in Turkey are very much connected to abroad and exhibiting. Before coming here, we were in the exhibition of Onur Atay. So they are, I mean, also sharing their works abroad. Contemporary art especially is the most transnational one. Film also. I mean, when you look at Turkish cinema, they are very much, I mean, shared and, I mean, followed abroad. But yes, I mean, this is something we should always keep in mind and emphasize, not limiting ourselves with our, I mean, local scene and local agenda. And also for example, I mean, it's not art, but the solidarity regarding Osman Kavala, it has been always transnational. I mean, from the beginning on, we didn't feel alone or isolated. We always felt the support and solidarity of people from abroad too. Not only from Turkey, but artists and curators and the institutions from abroad didn't leave us alone at any moment. So there is a transnational dimension in solidarity events also.
Thank you so much for this interesting discussion. We touched on a lot of topics, but sure, not all. We could go on, but there is afternoon afterwards, so we can drink something. But my last question is, we were talking about art, and we had this interesting term of laboring as looking at our togetherness or a new art of organization through neighboring. And we heard of listening also, listening to other people, listening to the stories, telling stories. So my last question is for everybody here on the panel, what was new listening to Adania, to Azena, to Ilir? What was new for you during this discussion? Has there been something, or surprising, or maybe everything was full?
Maybe I can start. I also tried to connect it with this art and the travel or transnational, which is connected. I mean, it's a bit funny because I thought of Kosovo, and Kosovo is hopefully the last country in Europe which has to go through the visa regime to travel to Europe. And I mean, this of course makes it very harder to have this exchange and impact, which is very important, not just for artists and culture. It's so important. My closest friends, they say I'm not going through that process because it makes me feel like I'm not human. And I really understand that, because it makes you go through an unhuman process and sort of makes us more distant to other places. And I mean, I connect this with what you said, and you, you know, I guess in every country you have the issues, but you always kind of identify, because we struggle the same things. If it's, you know, how live freely, or the freedom of movement, or, you know, like making it through. So, I mean, I always, you know, I think it's so important to have this exchange, because you just very quickly, you see the what connects us, even though we're not from the same nationality or from the same country. You just have a connection then on a different basis. And usually what more the right wing is approaching is trying to do the opposite, to find differences to make us,
separate.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I was also thinking of the commonalities that we're living through. And, I mean, trying to do something in difficult context and with repressive states, and, I mean, this is making me feel I'm not alone and I should continue. And this neighboring thing was also interesting, I mean, in terms of the connection with what I have been thinking in Turkey. Yeah.
Yeah, and going back to, I was thinking about the transnation, because I think it is, it's not accessible to everybody, as you say. It is, it's not even on a local level. Sometimes we have this possibility. And perhaps today I'm also starting to think again that we forget to connect with each other without the center of powers being in the middle of us. And I think this is important to remember, that this maybe if we take neighboring, not as a geographical or special relation, but also neighboring in our experiences and learning and listening to each other, which I think was more possible in the 60s and 70s, but now we are moving to more isolation, almost loneliness. And perhaps we go back to what you talk about, the sense of responsibility. I mean, even I think it gives you an agency in terms of acting when you feel responsible, even if you are being pushed to the farthest place, to the most isolated. I think sensing responsibility to those who are equally unprivileged is important. Not that you feel responsible for the powerful, but of course you would always feel responsible for those. And now we have a lot of separation. I mean, I see the cause of women and black people and LGBT communities and the Jewish and the Arabs and the asylum. Everybody's away. We are not speaking together, but we are speaking constantly to a powerful, to convince them of our pain. And I think we have this responsibility towards each other, which perhaps I would go on thinking about.
Yes, thank you. Thank you very much for all your contributions, for all your thoughts tonight. Thank you. Thank you very much. Demokratie.